Hi, and welcome to the AdLand podcast. We're here today together with AdPulp's founder and main writer, David Byrne. Welcome, David.
Well, thank you so much, Osk. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, we were just chatting right before I started recording about how long you've been running AdPulp, and it's 16 years soon.
Yes, in October, it will be 16 years. We started in October of 2004, when I lived in Chicago, and my partner in AdPulp at Sean Hartley lives in Omaha and lived in Omaha. So we worked on it together, and off to the races we were. It was a very different time back then. It seems like when we launched that AdPulp really kind of shot out of a rocket. It was the right time to do that, and it's, you know, definitely a different time now.
Yeah, it was a big boom of, well, I would call it ad commentary sites, because I don't like the term blog. It doesn't I know it was really trendy to call it a blog back then, but to me a blog was always like somebody's journal and not actual reporting and commentary on other things.
Indeed. I mean, at the time I had no problem with the term blog. I think somewhere over the last 10 years that term was left behind, and your site, my site, these are clearly industry websites, media properties, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so blog doesn't fit it. It's not a personal journal of any sort. It's we're covering a really important and powerful industry in our various ways.
Yeah. And when it comes to covering the industry, it's a rarity that creatives are properly covering. I know that in the traditional trade press, such as Campaign, you will have creatives write the occasional opinion piece and stuff. But most of the time, it's journalists covering our work rather than us discussing our work.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one route into being a journalist, right? I see it as there's two routes. You go to journalism school and you learn how to be a journalist, and then you go and get a job, and then on that job you may work for a trade magazine and you cover the ad business, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. The other route is you don't go to journalism school. You become an expert in whatever that is. In this case, it's advertising. It could be another thing. And then you turn that expertise into something new, which in this case is industry coverage and journalism. So it's the insider's point of view. You and I are both practitioners. And that, for me, makes a huge difference, because if a practitioner is forwarding a point of view, especially consistently, there's a reality and some gravitas there that might be missing if just a trade journalist is doing it.
Oh yeah, I agree. And there's more people doing it now than back in 2004. There were very few people doing it back then. I mean, do you remember what the landscape looked like?
Well, there was you and AdRants. Mm-hmm. Paid content, Rafat Ali's site was one that I was looking at the time to kind of inform what I wanted to do with AdPulp. And the reason I mentioned that is that the intention at the very beginning, and has been throughout, was for it to be a business. Whether that's a side hustle or not is another discussion. But the intention from day one was, we're a business. We're a trade journal. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's played out in different ways, and we've evolved and things have changed. But the intention was there, and I was looking at you and AdRants and then Rafat Ali's site, and I just said, you know, we have to get into this. We have a lot to say. I have a lot to say as a writer. And that's another thing, is that AdPulp has become a writing practice for me. So I've been writing on the site as we started here a minute ago, 16 years almost. And anything you're going to do for 16 years on pretty much a daily basis, you know, you're going to get good at it, I would hope. So if it was guitar and I played guitar every day for 16 years, I think I could jam.
Yeah, well, I read it, so I think you're good at it.
Well, thank you so much. I read your stuff, and we support one another. It's funny. Here's a question for you. Do the trades read us?
I don't know. I know that they used to. I know. I'm not going to name him because at a dinner at Cannes, he admitted he basically built his career by finding the oddities and articles on Adland, and then he put that in a paper magazine on the back page for the fun and the odd advertising news. And he was basically cribbing that straight off of Adland. And and he still works in the business. But
you've had quite a few problems with drafters. I see you're still battling the unkind trade journalists that want to use your trademarked name over and over.
Yeah, I find that to be quite tedious. I think it's like picked up quite a bit recently that we're using that term in American headlines, and it becomes an issue because people email me about it, and and it's like, could you stop doing that? Because I don't want to offend your emails, really.
And the thing is, let's get down to it. There's a very small handful of journalists that were, and editors and copy editors that we're discussing here that make these decisions. It's not like you can't reach out to them and say, please stop before I get my lawyer on you. It's not like there's some huge monolithic, like, oh, the New York Times has to stop saying Adland. it's a little different.
Yeah,
but that's why I just wonder, are they doing it unconsciously, which is probably the case, or are they doing it to provoke, or just carelessness? What are the motivations? It's probably just unconscious.
Because I don't want to believe that anybody's just doing it to be nasty.
Right.
Although sometimes it feels that way.
Well, I know. Let's blame the English, okay? We'll just leave
We'll blame the Brits.
Hey, they need to take some blame, just like us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's true, though. I mean, about it being a handful of journalists, you see them go from like Adweek to DigiDay to Business Insider. And then it was like Stuart Elliott went from New York Times to Business Insider. They really just like sort of circle around the same areas, don't they?
They do. And the mention of Stuart leads me to just sort of a reminder, which is that back in 2004, newspapers, and for a few years after that, newspapers employed advertising critics,
yep,
and people that covered the advertising beat. Louis Lazar in Chicago Sun-Times covered Ad Pulp within 2 weeks of our launch. Those people, there's no such thing as a newspaper journalist on this beat. And what I would like to say about that is, are you kidding me? It's like, well, we're not going to write about oil and gas, or we're not going to write about food and beverage, or marketing communications needs to, there's somebody's got to be on the beat.
Yeah. And the only one that I can think of was Tim that went from Financial Times in the UK to Financial Times in San Francisco. And his beat sort of changed from advertising to tech while he did that. But he was actually on the ad beat before.
Yeah. I mean, there are a smattering of journalists. I'm not saying that they don't exist. But before there were these, Stuart Elliott was, you know, a famous columnist for the Times. And, you know, that job just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And so what we have are some trade journals. And the trade journals really have a very, very cozy relationship with the people and the entities that they cover, don't they? I think they really do. I think it's like they're beyond in bed together, you know?
There's that they get paid for certain things, like the ad of the day is something you pay for.
But with a lack of transparency.
Right.
Because, oh, we're real journalists. Well, you know, let's stop playing games. Where do you get your money?
Yeah.
That's always the question. And when you get to the answer, then you can understand what is motivating this company or this group of people. Where does the money come from? So if the big agencies like the Wieden & Kennedys of the world, you know, aren't supporting Adweek or Ad Age and vice versa, they need each other. I mean, and they both know it and they both somehow enjoy that relationship. But, you know, from my perspective, it, you know, obviously I'm deep into this, but it doesn't. It just looks like straight up PR, like all day long.
Yep. And it's not like you see anything critiquing anything either. They've put themselves in a position where they can't actually question what certain brands are doing.
You think Adweek or Ad Age wants to question Nike or Wieden and Kennedy?
Absolutely not.
Well, I do.
You do? I mean, they should, but they don't want to, is what
I'm
saying.
No, I want to.
Yeah.
I want to question them and do. Mm-hmm. Because somebody has to, you know, because, I mean, they're a classic case, really a classic case of you know, who, what is this company, Nike, and what is this agency, Wieden and Kennedy? They certainly have amazing polish. They look good, real good, but don't scratch that polish.
Yeah, it's all surface. That's the problem with it. It's all surface.
Well, I mean, start looking closely at Nike and just the whole, start peeling that onion, and then ask yourself, what role does Wieden and Kennedy have in this? A lot of people have said Nike made Wieden and Kennedy. Other people said Wieden and Kennedy made Nike. I see two toxic cultures.
Oh, yeah.
But Adweek's not going to tell you that, kids.
No, they're not. I mean,
you heard it here first.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the latest Nike ad really exposed them. And I think, or I hope at least, that the consumers who were complaining about it, because now there were many consumers complaining about it, and they're in different camps. I think it exposes their hypocrisy quite a bit, and I hope that the consumers who were saying that they're going to boycott them will this time around, because people keep saying that they're going to boycott big companies when they get upset with the ads, but I don't see them actually doing it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, having lived in Portland for 10 years, you know, the swoosh is beloved in Portland, and you would think of all people that the Portlanders would be deeply critical of their labor practices and other things, but they're not. They proudly wear the swoosh all around town.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the swoosh has unbelievable power. They employ about 18,000 people in the Portland area. So who's going to criticize the swoosh? Is the Oregonian? These people have immense power. They're the only Fortune 500 company in the state of Oregon, you know, and on and on. But we have other topics to discuss.
Well, I was going to say, like, how has the advertising commentary changed? Because we were already touching on that. We used to have in the newspapers people like Stuart Elliott and Bob and everybody else who were criticizing new advertising campaigns in columns. And now we don't have that anymore, but we have instead lots and lots of websites that are displaying ads or trying to report on advertising. And there's a ton of little, like, I don't know, ads of the world type sites pop up every day. Mm-hmm. And then they disappear like a year or two later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's sort of a bunch of points and questions kind of packed in there. Number one, you know, the creatives have always, you know, they want to look at the work. They want to look at the work. And, you know, the work I'm doing on AdPulp is, I certainly don't call it long form writing, but the articles are, I don't know, 600 to 1200 words long. And you have to sort of ask, who's reading this, and is this the most effective way? And then what are your goals, right? Because if your goal is just to have your website blow up and be some profit-making machine or whatever, then you might need to re-engineer the way you do things. I would like AdPulp to make more money than it does, but that isn't the goal. My goal is to extend my writing practice, to share my knowledge, my know-how with the community, because I want to kind of uplift when I can and criticize when I have to. As far as what everyone else is doing, you know, I used to read the trades religiously, to be honest, in the beginning, and I really don't now. Muse by Cleo is one that I do really appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Nudd is doing a great job with that, and I think that's an interesting play from the Cleos. It's kind of a content play from the Cleos, and I like that. I think that's kind of smart all the way around. So there's some respect there. But, you know, do I go to Ad Age and Ad Week and do I pay and do I deal with their paywalls and on? No. And that gets into, well, why not? Don't you need that informed point of view? And it's no, not at this point. I mean, I'm flooded with PR on a daily basis, as I'm sure you are.
Yeah.
My inbox is overflowing with pitches. The most of them, you know, are really bad. But there's some gems that come through and that I want to, you know, elevate to the site. But where do the stories come from? And you know, the PR teams are cranking out these press releases, and Ad Age and Ad Week are getting them, you know, the same day we are. I think there are some people that try to stagger it and put them above us and give them a day, you know, give them a 24-hour lead or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know,
very silly.
It's irrelevant to me because I'm not even looking over there. I mean, I'm going to cover something because it's worth covering. End of story.
Yeah. Exactly. Or the my favorite thing to hate is when they give you a link from somebody else going, see, we've already gotten press over here. And it's like,
ooh, here's some coverage. Cool.
I'm like, I don't care.
Oh, neat. Some coverage. Oh, why don't I draft off of that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. It used to be, I remember for a while there, people were actually commenting on Adland, you got this from Ad Week or something. And it's because we're getting the press releases at the same time. And I get so tired of it. It was just, I hated that they would assume that I went to Ad Week and read their thing and then wrote my thing when I have the same PR mail in my inbox.
Exactly. So which one of us is the best at breaking down a press release? And, you know, we don't want to do that all day long, do we? We want to do better than that. I do. Yeah. I would be bored silly if that's what I was doing.
Yeah. I mean, breaking down a press release is whatever. It's not putting food on my table. So
food on the table. There's a great topic. How does food on the table relate to our two websites?
Yeah, like you're venturing into this area of getting a Patreon, which I find really interesting. And people have told me to do ages ago, but I don't think it's suitable for Adland in the same way. You know what I mean?
Yes. So I did not want to do Patreon for the longest time because I associated it with crowdfunding. I don't now. I see it as a subscriber platform that I, you know, wouldn't enact myself on AdPulp. So I'm using, you know, their software as a service to work with subscribers. But the motivating move behind, you know, opening up the Patreon in April is the Emerging Voices Project. So basically that's for young writers coming out of school, and I want to pay them to write. And so I'm using the subscriber income to pay these new writers. And so because I have the entire Patreon pitch and delivery mechanism set up to do that, it's not about, hey, I have server bills and you should really pay me and all that. So it's much more appealing because it's not that. And it's, oh, you're paying these Gen Z emerging voices to offer their point of view, and you're actually giving them real money to do so. So yes, we want to support that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way for the young ones to sharpen their skills too.
It's, you know, it's interesting. They are certainly getting something out of it, no doubt. Including, you know, some exposure, but I'm getting something out of it in both a professional way that attaches to AdPulp being better and more valuable, but also in a personal way. I maybe didn't expect this part when I came up with the idea, but I'm living it now, which is, you know, having five or six people who are in their early 20s, you know, in my world right now, you know, in my Slack, in my email, talking to me on the phone, writing articles, getting paid. They are providing me on a personal level, a new level of energy and hope It's sort of like young people keep you young. And, you know, you hear that kind of stuff, but then all of a sudden it kind of happens to you and you're like, oh, really? This is great. Mm-hmm. So I'm digging it, really. And I'd like more people to, you know, be part of it, more writers, more subscribers. But it's going pretty well, but I have to keep realizing it's still new. You know, it's not even 6 months in, and, you know, so we're still growing it. And I did find some new writers recently, and so we're going to be bringing some more voices forward here shortly.
Cool. I mean, it's funny too, because I just realized a lot of these ad commentators, you are, and a bunch of other people are writers. Steve Hall was media, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. And I'm probably the only art director.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm honing my skill of writing that I don't actually use at all at work.
Well, you know, and there's a lot more to it than that, of course, you know, besides the writing. And some sites are just really visual. And as we were just saying a minute ago, a lot of the ad people, they don't want my writing, quite frankly. Some do. The people who are really into strategy and you know, taking topics and going in depth and want to read that stuff. But a lot of people, you know, a bigger market wants to click, glance, scroll.
Yep. And now you can do that on Twitter. I mean, the web world has changed so much. You no longer have like a group of people coming to comment on new ads on the site, because those may have been spread all over Twitter already. So
yeah, I mean, we're not even really trying to get comments, honestly, hardly on our sites now, because that's just not what people do. They're going to, if they want to take your story and make a comment or share it, they're going to do it on social. Here's an interesting thing for the listeners to grab onto. Your site and adpulp.com were created prior to YouTube, prior to Twitter, and right at the same, at least for me, right at the same time as Facebook. So, you know, predating social media, there was a time when this is what I said about shooting out of the rocket. You know, there was no place to go with it. AdPulp, AdLand, AdRants was it. So you would comment there, and that was the community, and that was the participation. That got blown into smithereens. So what we experienced actually is exactly what all media companies experienced, which is, you know, we had this sort of, we had an audience, a rather large audience at that time, focused on our media product. And now it's splintered into a million bits.
Yeah, it's interesting. And there's a new generation that's come in during this time too. A lot of people, I feel that we were always educating a little bit. Like half of the reason we're doing it is to help educate other people.
No question. We changed the tagline recently to advertising news and know-how. And the know-how part is really important, because the news is great to see a new campaign that's inspiring or whatever it may be. Getting the expert's take on it, the opinion, if you want to go that way, you know, our opinions are based on the things that we've lived. So, you know, a trade journalist, for instance, has never been thrown under the bus by a client, has never worked on a project for 3 months and then had the client, you know, take a dump on it. It just isn't part of their experience, but it is part of my experience, and it is part of your experience, and all people that work in advertising know what that's like.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, I've worked in different countries, so I've also looked at campaigns at like what the market is over there, mm-hmm. rather than seeing it with, say American eyes or something that I've noticed that some trade mags do, and they'll get upset about certain casting choices or something, but it's like the ad is airing in Thailand. It's like, you have to understand that's a different country and they may react differently, or it's Australia or, you know, somewhere
sure.
else.
Sure. Sure.
And so, I mean, I always enjoy, like, I know that you're part of the Epica Award judges too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's my favorite part about judging the Epicas, is that I get to see stuff from like the Ukraine and Russia. And I'm always surprised by all the stuff coming out of Russia that's so creative. I'm like, why aren't they sending these press releases to us? It's so good.
That's an interesting point. You know, all the English-speaking countries are, when it comes to the web, are united in the sense of you know, if I want to look at an Australian or South African site, and we get some traffic from those countries. I'm really interested right now in finding an emerging writer out of Mexico or Latin America who can help us to, again, expand our coverage and our point of view. And that's sort of my big pitch to these younger writers, is that, you know, I'm 55 years old and they're 30 years younger than me. So no matter what, our experiences and the things we think about and the way that we approach things and, you know, such are different, vary. So I'm really wanting all those inputs from them to not necessarily, I wouldn't say challenge my own, but I'm happy to be challenged, but, you know, to mix it all together, you know, to hear from other people, because what happens, like you were saying about Twitter, we all have our Twitter people, and it becomes a kind of a tight circle in a way, you know. And I was thinking about this a while ago, but, you know, I don't have a lot of young people in my Twitter world. You know, it's people that you know, I've been following or been following me for a long time, or we discover each other now, but we're of similar ages and backgrounds and things. And so that's natural. That's what happens on social. You go into these, you know, groups, these tribes. You're in your tribe.
Yeah, bubbles.
And I'm trying to say, like, that's not going to work for AdPulp. We've got to expand beyond that.
Yeah. I might actually know somebody who can get you in touch with emerging writers, because I know a tutor at the advertising school in Mexico City.
Well, I would love that. And a student also, somebody who's, you know, studying communications in some form, might be also a really good person to be an emerging writer. So far, they're all out of school and in their, you know, early in their career. But that doesn't mean that a junior or senior in college studying advertising wouldn't also be a good addition.
Hmm. It's interesting, because I think that's the main difference between us and the other trade press, the altruism. And I'm just looking at how the other trade press right now are sort of seemingly desperate to make money, because sometimes you come to their pages for a while there before everybody started lockdown for subscription only. There was a lot of really, really terrible advertising. Like, you know, those ads that you like, the Taboola type of ads, like the stuff that you see on really shady magazines, mm-hmm. was all over the trade press all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't make any money off of those kinds of ads at all.
We've tried a lot of different approaches over the 16 years, including running cheesy ads. I eventually got to a place where I felt that anything like that was diminishing our own product. And then here's the weird part is that, you know, as an advertising expert and as an advertising site, we don't run digital advertising, and then, you know, somebody, like right now you're asking, well, why is that? Well, almost all of it is low grade. It's not high quality advertising, so why would I want to put that in front of an audience?
Mm-hmm.
If you can put something of quality in front of our audience, then we should talk.
Yeah, exactly. I think that there's a problem with the advertising online in general, but in particular in trade magazines that are actually focused on a topic. The advertising isn't designed for that at all. They're not thinking of, like, what we used to think of when we were putting things in like specific type of magazines, we would make the ad for that magazine. You're making the ad to be in Sports Illustrated. You know, nobody's thinking that way when it comes to online advertising.
Yeah. And think about our sites. If you were in the production community right now, a director, or, you know, had some other role, and you wanted to speak to creative directors, I wonder how you would go about doing that. I mean, come on. Can we just like snap our fingers and like, you know, come to some kind of new realization about how things actually work? We have a bunch of creative directors, super big time creative directors looking at our stuff. So why wouldn't you want to put your article? It could be a paid article, transparent. We want to say this was put here with, you know, money. Or your ad, or whatever it is that you'd like to work with us on, so you can get in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
it's not a mystery. I mean,
it really isn't. I mean, it's like we should be the ideal spot because we're extremely focused, narrowly focused,
and so
is the audience.
You're right. And here's what I'm going to hear from some people: well, your audience share is, you don't have enough. Don't have enough visitors.
They're always talking about numbers as if that's a thing.
And I'm like, do you want conversion or do you want to play some other game?
Yeah.
Because I'm about conversion, because I'm an ad pro. I'm about conversion, gentlemen and ladies. So if you'd like my help with that, I can help you. you don't need 20,000 people a day on your website. You can have 200 if they're the right 200.
Exactly.
Again, with the basics, it's like, do I sound frustrated right now? Because I am. It's just so basic.
It's so true, though. But I mean, the industry really shot itself in the foot when they started talking about big numbers rather than the right target. And that's when everything started going downhill. And coincidentally, that's around 2004.
Big numbers. I mean, it's back to the, like, I'm just on a so what page. Big numbers of people doing what?
Yeah, that's why click. BuzzFeed happened. Yeah.
Click.
And that's, yeah.
Glance. Scroll.
Yeah.
So you got 20,000 people doing what? Click, glance, scroll. Hey, that's a high value buy, guys. You know, get in there. Get in there on that.
And that's how you got like places like the Gawker Empire like blowing up and then collapsing because it was all based on that sort of thing. Clicks.
Cool. Right, and even today there are so many more that are just playing this bottom feeder game, and you know, when is it gonna end? You know, like the media business, for instance, is, you know, like the ad business, on very tough times. It's time to make a new decision.
Yeah, I was actually hoping this pandemic that everybody is incredibly tired of will reset these things because people are doing different with their time now.
I call it the hard reset, but I think what's interesting about that is that it's hard for people to do. Just take paywalls, all right? Just as an example, so we make this concrete. You know, paywalls work for the New York Times and I suppose the Washington Post. And, you know, Warren Buffett said last spring that every newspaper in the United States was going to go out of business except those two. Wouldn't that send a chill down your spine if the Oracle of Omaha was saying that every newspaper in the country was going to go out of business? And he said, why? He said, because you've not learned how to do business online.
Yeah.
And now, if I worked at a newspaper, I would say to myself, is this paywall working? Yeah, there's 10,000 subscribers or however many there are. And there's this much income, so that's better than nothing. But what could we do if we rethought this problem? Because from a user experience, every time that I go from Twitter or anything and I land on gated content, it's a ding on the brand. It's horrible user experience. And, you know, it happens all in a matter of seconds, but I'm mad.
Yep.
So I can't do that on AdPulp. And, you know, again, I've tried everything. I've tried it. There's no way that you can do that. You can't give people that experience.
And yet with Patreon, it's working better for you. But when you ask for donations, that never like people always assume somebody else is donating.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. It's really interesting how it's been working. There have been some people, just a very small handful, who have come through social media tweets and other things, and people that I didn't know. Everyone else is someone I know, and it was handled through email. So if I don't email you and ask you to join the Patreon, and you're fully aware of it, you can see the tweets and you know, but you know, you just avoid. No, I'm not going to pay for content. Why would I? You know, David's got a great thing going, you know, that's very cool, but you know, I have to go like give him money now, $5 a month or whatever, $10 a month or more. I'm kind of busy right now.
Mm. Yeah. It's like the Kitty Genovese phenomenon, but for donations. And I think it's quite strange because there's people who are producing content on, say, YouTube and whatever, who managed to rack up a lot of Patreon patrons, and some of these people don't even do anything.
I'm
wondering, like, if it's because our focus is so narrow, or if it's because people in advertising are just cynical.
Well, it's yes. Sean's rap to me all these years it has been advertising people will not click an ad. So,
no.
So there you go. And cynical, yes. But, you know, some of us have somehow outgrown that, if you want to put it that way. And some of us are doing our best to usher in this next generation. I mean, basically, some of these patrons are major donors who are willing to put down some pretty serious money every month because they like the idea. They like the idea. They say they want to reward it. You know, they say that's a great idea. Let's hear from people that we're not hearing from.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a huge topic right now too. It's we're doing everything to bring more people into advertising that weren't working in advertising before. That's a big topic.
It's a huge topic, you know, privilege, white privilege, all of it, and yeah. tie portfolio schools into that. And you know, I keep seeing people saying, "Well, what a privilege that is to go to portfolio school," and of course it is.
Yeah, they're expensive. I went to one.
Right, and I almost. Did I deferred at Portfolio Center 4 times and they said you have to reapply. So I think I'll just not. But yeah, we had that privilege and you know that's great for us, but not everyone has far from it. Also, when you're going to get the Portfolio Center students all the time, what happens then? You know, this is my biggest problem with it is that you've created the formula.
Oh yeah. That's interesting because I can tell I do like mentor and critique books and stuff. You can tell what school people have gone to. So there's one in Sweden called Bergs, which is a really good school. You know exactly who went to Bergs versus who went to Hyper Island versus who went to Miami at school versus who went to Portfolio school.
And so, that then leads you to say, whose work is this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and like, I'm not helping anybody at Creative Circus anymore because they get offended. And it's like, if you're actually asking for your portfolio, which you're working on at a school right now, and you're asking for critiques of it, and I'm giving you some of that, and then you're sad, you might not be cut out to work in advertising.
Well, I'm not trying to laugh too hard, but the lesson number one is if, you know, you lack a thick skin, the first thing you need to do is to get one. And if you're not able to do that or willing to do that, then this is definitely not for you. Because your ideas are going to be shot down for the next 20 or 30 years. Do you know that? Do you know that you're going to have 100 ideas and that, you know, 3 or 4 are going to make it through?
Yeah. I mean, it is depressing. It's very, very, like, if you end up at an agency where nothing ever goes through, then, you know, you're working for 2 years and nothing is going through, you feel really, really bad. So you gotta, like, get used to it. You got to work on the fact that it's not personal.
It's so not personal. And I also believe deeply that great creatives have a deep reservoir of ideas. So even under the worst circumstances where you get thrown under the bus after 3 months or whatever, and like I mentioned, the response may be anger just because you're a human being, but you need to soon get over that and say to yourself, okay, I have another idea that's just as good as that or maybe better. Maybe this is a gift because I know I have an unlimited number of these ideas. That's the job. That's where people need to go. Don't whine and cry that the idea got killed for unjust reasons. That's life. Say, it's okay. I'm being paid really well to do this work. Thank you. Thank you. Gratefulness. And I have more ideas.
Yep. I mean, that's also part of it. In the beginning, students don't really get paid. I think that's probably the biggest hurdle for having a business that is more diverse and has more women at the top and whatever. I mean, I think we're also ignoring that they're constantly talking about putting more women at the top. I think we're ignoring the fact that a lot of women actually enjoy having children. And when you have children, you're not going to be working 24 hours a day. So what the problem is there is the work life aspect that advertising like sort of means has to have you on call for 24 hours a day. I mean, we're not curing cancer. You should be able to clock off at 5.
That's a disease, the overworking disease. And it's beyond the ad business, but you know, we're discussing within the ad business, but that's a disease that there's no need for. All you have to do is create efficiencies inside your organization that optimize coming up with good ideas and producing them. And you can go home at 5 or 6 o'clock like a normal working person. And you should.
Yeah. I think it's important that advertising agencies do that. And now that everybody's working from home, I see a lot of people complain that they're actually on call more than they were when they actually separated work from, you know, the home time.
There's no boundaries. And I think with people being laid off and losing their jobs and all these demands being put on people, you know, there's abuse happening out. There's abuse happening out there. And you know, it makes me think that I'll go ahead and extend this idea because I think why in the world do we lack unions in the ad agency business? And of course, you know, the owners wouldn't want them, just like every owner in every industry would not want them. But our industry has so many problems that are labor related problems. We need a labor movement.
Yeah, no, that's really funny. Now we're back to Adland being misused, because there's a guy on Twitter who is saying that he really wants to create a union for Adland. And every time he says that, people ping me.
So, oh, okay. Okay. He means for the industry, which is a good idea.
Yeah, it is a good idea. And also the terms advertising industry are good to use.
Correct. Correct.
Instead of my trademark name, but.
Correct. So I've kind of liked the word Adlandia, but you know, that's a derivative of your trademark name. So I'll leave it alone.
I like that word too, but I think there was a duo of young creatives who actually had, I think, a podcast under that name.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But yeah, I think it's the end of the holding company era right now, because they were always driving so hard to just have a more money at the bottom line, and they have the huge offices and people at offices like 72 and Sunny. They're renting out the space of their office because they just don't have enough clients to pay for that giant space. So they're renting it out to other creatives and photographers and that sort of thing. And so that's a in stark contrast to like 4 years ago when they just could, they were hiring anybody who walked through the door because they needed more people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think
this is a crisis for the industry and for many others, and we're going to see how well we respond. You know, I don't have a lot of faith that, you know, we're going to respond well. Although I think in pockets we will. For instance, like We Are Rosie, that would be a pocket where, okay, well, I'm going to be independent. I don't need to work at a big firm in New York or LA. I'm good. I'm part of this We Are Rosie community, and I'm getting work. I haven't gotten any work from them or anything. I'm just saying there are some excellent developments right now, but they're happening, you know, over there on the fringe. And I don't mean to say that they're on the fringe, but it's not the holding company deal anymore. And they are, what are they holding? I mean, it's things are changing. And I've been hearing from several people in the industry that you know, they're going to downsize their office or get rid of it.
Yeah. Well, I've seen also like a lot of very, very experienced people are starting their new agencies. So we have like Fearless started up, and then we have mm-hmm. Nine Lives, which is Eric Funke's new agency. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen a lot of people who, well, were maneuvered out because they are at that senior point where they're probably the most expensive guy on the list, and they're bringing their skills to new clients and starting new things away from the holding companies who are all only looking at the bottom line. And I think it's important to understand that what advertising business is actually selling is the people who know how to make ads. Mm-hmm. And you can't lose those.
Make ads that work.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much garbage made every day, and it passes as advertising. And this is why our industry is loathed by millions, because we produce mental garbage until we don't, you know? Yeah. But 9 out of 10, I mean, if you were to ask me, 9 out of 10 are bad. And yeah. and 1 out of 10 ads are offering the people who are looking at it some value, whether it's entertainment or information or whatever it is. 1 out of 10 is not good. So the structures and the framework and the systems that we currently are using to work that have obviously got to change. 1 in 10?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do. If you were Ford Motor Company and you in 1 in 10 cars off the line were worth driving, I don't think you'd survive for long.
No. I mean, if you think about it, the ads actually just look like a paint by numbers kind of thing. I've seen a lot of ads recently that, you know, do whatever, here's the product as solution. You got this. And with blocky, like white text on mm-hmm. colorful screens. I'm really sick of everything looking the same and having the same tone of voice. And mm-hmm. it's, and I can't even remember half of the brands it's doing it for, because I got this. Who owns that phrase?
Right. I mean, the sea of sameness right now is insane, because you've got people like Gary Vee saying, create 1,000 pieces of content a day. What has that led to?
Junk.
A real mess of digital yeah. debris that none of us need. The brands that buy it from them, they don't need it. Do they? I don't think so.
No.
Do any brands need digital debris to, you know, sell their wares? I don't think so. That's not to say you shouldn't do social. That's to say, what are you doing on social, and why, and how is it working?
Yeah. And the way social is right now, it seems that the only way a brand can stand out on social is to pick a fight.
Right.
Like we saw Evian do with Coors the other day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It just looks stupid to me. It's like, those are two different mountain ranges. What are you doing?
Well, you know, it goes back to this thing that I've been sort of hammering away on, this sort of click, gaze and scroll thing. it's how do you break through in that environment? And you know, the president of the United States knows how. You have to be absolutely over the top in your delivery and create some kind of scene. Otherwise, you will be ignored. Yeah. What I'm trying to say, though, is that doesn't work for brand building.
No, I can't think of like, can we find a brand that launched online and built an actual brand online?
Well, that's the ad contrarian's patented line, basically. Give me the proof. Point me to the company that has, you know, built this brand online. And I do think that there are several small companies throughout the world that could be pointed to appease Bob on some level with that. But you know, Bob's background was selling Toyota cars and McDonald's hamburgers. So the ad guy is trying to say, would I use Twitter or Facebook if I still own my agency to support my Toyota dealers and my McDonald's operators? Would that be the way that I would go about it? Or would I probably prefer to rely on what actually works, which is to create these television spots that drive people to the store?
Facebook, I don't understand why any brand would want to be seen there, especially considering the comments that you get.
Again, it's this chasing the dragon, right? Of where are these, you know, mythic creatures called our audience? Well, they're on Facebook.
Are we sure? The audience always seems to be a whole bunch of like anybody in the range of 15 to 95.
Well, of course, because your product's for everyone.
Yes. They can never narrow it down. It's frustrating.
See what happens when you get two ad people on a call like this on a podcast. You have so much to say.
Back to Ad Pulp. I love the fact that you're giving a soapbox for the younger generation to share their insights on advertising. And I wish you like the best of luck with that. I think that's really cool.
I'm glad
it's working out. And I'm going to remind everybody who hears this that you actually have to go to the Patreon page and hit the donate button to support that.
That would be terrific. And, you know, I've tried to say that it's not about the amount of money every month that you're able to subscribe at. It can be as low as $1. It can be $2 or $3 or $4 or $5. And that should be, you know, affordable for anyone working in the business. And what I'm saying though is that there are more things happening than just how much money can we bring in. We want momentum for the program. So if you do land on the Patreon and you are thinking, well, I could give $1 a month. I think some people don't want to do that because they're like, well, I wouldn't want to give them $1 a month. I want the $1 a month because I want the relationship with the subscriber.
Yeah, we shouldn't underestimate $1 a month. It used to be to see the commercials on Adland, that was $2 a month. And that covered buying new servers when I had to buy the physical machines because so many people were putting a couple of dollars a month. So it's like, great, now I have enough to buy a new machine.
Exactly.
You can't underestimate the many single dollars.
And I don't. And I feel like I got some major donors to embrace this idea in the beginning. And then there's been some people that have come since then, but I'm really wanting to get more people in. And if it means helping people to see that I totally value your $1 or $2 or $3 a month in a big way. And so do these emerging writers who are, you know, getting paid. As soon as I publish their article, I pay them on PayPal. At the same time, because part of this whole program is about, we can create structures that do things the right way. One of the things that's never right is, when am I going to get paid? I sent you an invoice and I don't know if the check is in the mail or not. Mm-hmm. We're past that. Here's my PayPal. Give me the money that I labored for.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, for too long, the value of creative works such as writing or art directing has been completely undervalued by the internet's new way of throwing content everywhere and not paying people who created it. So I really appreciate that you're paying them.
That, to me, that's the entire point of it. One of the main points of it, I should say, because without that, it's not the same. No. Without that, you're on this, I'll give you, a chance to, you know, write an article for our audience and that'll be great. And no, you know, what's great is I worked and I got paid.
Yeah. I mean, it's like everybody keeps saying, well, it will give you exposure. You can die of exposure.
Exactly. Word.
All right. That was great. Thank you so much for coming to the Adland podcast. I really enjoyed having you here.
Well, this is really fun. Great chat with you. Thank you so much. And I look forward to hearing us out there on the inner tubes.
On the inner tubes.